This is the one.
Anyway, welcome everybody. I want to give a special shout out. Hope everybody is staying well, but a special shout out to many of the Shoresh teens that are on here tonight. They're making their presence felt, which we appreciate. But just to review some of the basics, everybody is welcome to speak up, ask a question, interact, you know, offer your opinion. But for the most part, we have found that if you don't leave yourself on mute, very often there's a side conversation or an advertisement or something else gets involved. So do me a favor and just keep it on mute unless you have something to share. So, but by all means, feel free. So tonight, on Wednesday nights, we've been going through what we call text messages of trying to look and examine a certain aspect of the text of this week's Torah portion and try to analyze it in a way that we perhaps have never seen before. For this particular class, I want to ask you a question, and you're welcome to think about it, or you're welcome to write down your answer. But here's the question. When did the Exodus from Egypt actually begin? Well, if you were with us last night, we talked about when it ended. We talked about it ending really at the holiday of Shavuot. That's fine. But now my question is, when does the Exodus experience actually begin? Lots of possibilities. JJ?
Was it when Yitzchak was born?
Is that you're referring to that the question he thinks I'm asking?
What does the Torah say?
All right, relax. When does the 400 years, the 400 years that was predicted that the Jews would be in a foreign land that Abraham was told about, when does that actually begin? So JJ is correct. One opinion has it that it starts with the birth of Isaac already, because that's exactly 400 years to the day as far as leaving Egypt. That's true, but I'm asking a different question. I don't want to know when the 400 years began. I want to know when the seeds of the Exodus were planted and ultimately grew into the Exodus experience. Just think about it, make a mental note, and you'll see if your answer matches with mine. We're told in the beginning of this week's Torah portion of Parshat Vayeshev, this is now, we've gone through Abraham and Sarah, we've gone through Isaac and Rebekah, we've made it through Jacob, Rachel is no longer, she's passed on already when she gave birth to Binyamin. And now we're moving into the next phase of the growth of the Jewish nation, where it was the patriarchs and matriarchs. We are now transitioning into the 12 tribes, the family that's going to become 70 individuals working their way down to Egypt. But our parsha now begins the story of Joseph. Joseph takes center stage here, of where Joseph has this two dreams. He has two dreams that he shares with his brothers, which he shares with his family. And the brothers don't take too kindly to his dreams. And they decide that they're going to get rid of him. The opportunity obviously presents itself. Joseph is sent on a mission to go check up on his brothers. The brothers see him coming. They take him. First, they decide they're going to kill him. No, one of the brothers convinces them that's not the appropriate thing to do. Rather, let's throw him in a pit. Ultimately, he's sold into slavery to the passing caravan going down to Egypt, yada, 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 and we all know the rest of the story. What triggered the jealousy and the hatred the brothers had for Joseph? Listen, I have siblings. Many of you have siblings, and I'm sure that our siblings have said things that we would prefer that they didn't say. But to get to a point of where they're ready to kill their sibling, what triggered all of this? So the Torah tells us this in the very beginning of the parsha, that the brothers felt that there was a certain level of favoritism that Jacob showed towards Joseph in particular. It's become very well known that this famous coat of many colors is what it's called. In Hebrew, the Torah tells us the following. It says, and Israel, referring to Jacob, loved Joseph more than all his sons. Number one, since he was a child of his old age, right? Joseph was number 11 of the 12, so it clearly was not right away. And therefore, he made him a fine woolen tunic. He made him this coat of many colors. In Hebrew, it's called ketonet pasim, the tunic of many colors. That's what it's called. And we all know the rest, as we said, the rest of the story, because when the brothers decide that they're not going to kill him, they're going to throw him in a pit. Hopefully he'll die and be the end of it. What do they do with that tunic? They take it off of him. They slaughter an animal and they dip his coat in blood. And they're going to present that to Jacob and say, ay, 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 poor Joseph. He got devoured by a wild animal. Ay, 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 ay. That's, we know, right? Anybody, we're all familiar with this story. And we've heard this many, many times. But here's where it gets complicated. This word, ketonet, means a garment or a tunic. Pasim, it's a weird word. It's not clear from the context even what it means. All of the commentators try to understand the root of the word. It's an unusual word. You don't find many words throughout the entire Tanakh that have that same root. But what I want to share with you is a very out-of-the-box, strange interpretation that is going to beg for some explanation that's going to explain where I want to go with this tonight. I have two messages that I want to learn from this. I'm reading from you from the Midrash. The Midrash on this verse about Jacob giving his son Joseph the ketonet pasim. The Midrash is also trying to make heads or tail of this word. One opinion is as follows. Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish b'shem Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, the great sage, Rabbi Shimon, said in the name of his master, of his teacher, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, he quotes a verse from Psalms. Lechu ure'u, go out and see, mifalot Elokim, the wondrous acts of God. The rest of the verse reads, Nora alila al b'nei Adam, who brings that sense of reverence and fear over man, hafach yam liyabasha, by turning the sea into dry land. And the Midrash finishes, lama vayisnu oto, why did God arrange for the brothers to hate Joseph? Bishvil sheyikara hayam lifnehem, so that the sea would ultimately be split before them. What? It's like you're throwing a million different pieces of information and it's not obvious the connection. Something about God and his wondrous actions causes man to realize how awesome God is. Proof of it is that God turns the sea into dry land. Oh, says the Mishnah, now I understand. The brothers hated Joseph because ultimately the sea is going to split before them. Finishes the Midrash with one word, pasim. You know what the word pasim means? It's a contraction of two words, pas yam. Pas yam. That's the word pasim, four letters. Pei samach yud mem. It divides it right in the middle. First word, pas, which means a pathway. Yam, the sea. A pathway through the sea. The word pasim that Jacob gave Joseph, this tunic, was a reference to God creating a path of dry land going through the sea. Are you as confused as I am?
Like we took a jump ahead in history.
Yeah, this is a serious jump in history. The story of Joseph and his brothers, right, is not the story. Let's put it the other way. The story of the splitting of the sea is more than 210 years after the story of Joseph and his brothers. It's actually much more than that, but it's minimally 210 years because that's the years of slavery and servitude that the Jews had in Egypt. What in tarnation is this talking about? The brothers hated him, splitting the sea. Awesome. That must be what the reference of this tunic is. Very difficult to understand.
Could it be the path that Joseph later in this chapter takes to look for his brothers when Israel sends him off to do that?
Maybe, but what's they got to do with a path in the middle of the sea?
Because that's the beginning of his path to getting to Egypt.
But where's the
sea? It's a stretch.
Well, I'm just trying to understand. It doesn't seem to have anything to do with the splitting of the sea. Joseph going to check up on his brothers, there's no crossing of any rivers of any sort. No water. It's like the state of Israel. There's no oil. Right? So how do we understand this? So we've talked about this concept in the past, but I want to refresh our memories a little bit. One of the most fundamental concepts in Judaism is that we try our best not to fall into the trap of short-sightedness. I know many of us who wear glasses, we are nearsighted. Many of us, myself included, we're nearsighted. Well, I think perhaps that is not just a physical malady that we are facing. I think that in terms of our mindset, most of us are short-sighted. We only look at things for a short period of time, and we try to understand it in a context, in a day, in a week. We expect the answers, like most sitcoms, to be answered in 30 minutes or up to an hour if it's a special. All answers of life's most difficult dilemmas get answered up in one show, one episode. That's the challenge that we as human beings face. The point that Judaism and the Torah teaches us is that we cannot take the short view. We have to look at the long view. Things that happen now, you have to take it in a context of a much broader, a much more global perspective. There's no incident that happened 100 years ago, 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, or even more, that didn't have and doesn't have a connection and a relevance to this moment right here, right now. We are in the midst of a long story that has many, many, many chapters. There's no way for anybody to understand a book by reading chapters 1, 4, 9, and 11 when there's 80 chapters in the book. How are you supposed to make heads or tails of it? I don't understand. I read chapter 9. It said specifically that he was dating so-and-so. How does the book, it doesn't make any sense. We have to know that there's a much longer view here. Let's explain further. I've given this analogy before. The guy comes to synagogue for the very first time. And he comes in and he sits down in the back. And it comes time of the service of where the gabbai is giving out the various honors. This one he's going to call up for the first aliyah. And this guy, so who does he choose? He chooses some guy in the third row. And then for the second aliyah, he calls up a guy who's all the way in the back on the other side. And then the third aliyah is a guy on the left. The fourth aliyah is for another dude who's standing in the hallway. He just went out to have a coffee. And a fifth guy. After services, the guy goes over to the gabbai, this first timer, and he says, that has got to be the worst system I've ever seen. It's so inefficient. If you're going to give out the honors, why don't you start in row 1, seat 1, give him the first honor, and then row 1, seat 2, and then seat 3, and go in order. What's this one over there and one over here? The gabbai, very patient individual, he looks at him and he says, "You're such an idiot. If you had come," obviously in the nicest way, right? "If you had just paid attention, or maybe even come previous weeks, you might have an understanding. Do you know why I didn't give the guy row 1, seat 1? It's because he got one last week." "Oh, okay, skip him. Go to row 1, seat 2. I'm not going to give him now because next week, in fact, is his father's yahrzeit, and I want to give him one next week." And the guy in seat three, he had a guest here. And I gave the guest 2 weeks ago, so that really covered his spot. And he has an answer for each person along the way. And he looks at the guy and he says, you have a question? Why? Because this is your first time here? You don't see the whole picture. You don't even have a sliver of an understanding. And you have questions? You think my system's so inefficient? God has been here forever. The world has been here for minimally, even the Jewish view, which is probably the shortest of all time. It's only 5,700 plus years. Yeah? And how long have we been here? 60 years? For you teens, you haven't even hit 20 years yet? And you got questions? God, how come this? How come I don't understand that? Where you been? Well, I understand. God looks at us and he says, this is like your first time in shul, dude. You don't understand my ways. You're good. It's not because my ways don't make sense. You're only seeing a fraction of the puzzle. One of the major issues that we face in life, forget Judaism, but just in life, we make so many decisions on a snap decision. We make our minds up based on one incident. We saw somebody do something or somebody said something. I'm not even talking about giving them the benefit of the doubt. That goes without saying. But even if the person said something wrong, did something wrong, that's it. We've decided that person is terrible. I can't believe he said that. She's such a no good Nick, blah, blah, blah. Hold on. You've never had a rough day? You've never said something that ticked somebody off that you didn't mean to say that way? You've never been angry? Can't judge everything based on one incident or even two incidents. A person is the composite of their entire life. It's certainly true when we talk about history. Understanding the Jewish history of what we've gone through. Life has its ups and downs. The story of Joseph and his brothers has to be taken in context and understood that this is the beginning of a very long story. The story does not end with Joseph being sold. We know that already because we know that the story continues of where Joseph is thrown in prison, goes through his 12 years of who knows what inside the prison, ultimately is taken out. What a change of events. He's appointed as the second in command under Pharaoh himself. He's like, this is your rags to riches story. Prisoner up to the second in command. And then he plays around and he's harsh with his brothers. And then he reveals himself and he tells them, listen to these words. When he finally reveals himself. If you want to see it, it's chapter 45, verses 5 through 7. He turns to his brothers. After he identifies himself, he tries to make nice with his brothers. And he says the following. He says, and now be not distressed, nor reproach yourselves for having sold me here. Don't be so hard on yourselves. Why? For it was to be a provider that God sent me here ahead of you. God put something in motion that ultimately will be for our benefit. Had I not been sold, I would not have been down here in Egypt. I would not have gone through what I went through and ultimately be in charge of Pharaoh and be in charge of the economy, storing everything up for the years of famine. I would have not been able to provide for our family. Yosef is telling his brothers, don't do this to yourself by being short-sighted. Okay? You can ask me, but they did something wrong. That's true. We have to deal with that. But the message Yosef is telling them, you need to look at the big picture, the overall picture. Yaakov himself has a hard time with this. Jacob, when he comes down to Egypt ultimately, and he comes before Pharaoh, the Torah tells us of a very strange conversation. Remember, the Torah is not just some cool novel that quotes some nice stories here and there to pique our interest. If there's a conversation that's quoted in the text itself, you have to ask yourself, what is so significant that the Torah wrote this down for posterity? When Jacob finally comes down and he meets Pharaoh, it says, Joseph brought Jacob, his father, and presented him to Pharaoh, and Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to Jacob, I'm in chapter 47, verse 8. Pharaoh said to Jacob, Kama yemei shnei chayecha? How many are the days of the years of your life? How old are you, man? Jacob answered Pharaoh, the days of the years of my sojourns have been 130 years. Few and bad have been the days of the years in my life, and they have not reached the lifespan of my forefathers in the days of their sojourns. Okay, weird conversation. Pharaoh's meeting Jacob, and that's what he cares. How old are you? Really? First of all, thank God it wasn't a woman, because that's a question you never, ever, ever ask. Don't ask how old you are. But even here, Pharaoh's asking, this is what the Torah needs to record. He didn't say to him, hi, welcome to Egypt. I'm sure he did, but the Torah didn't record that. He didn't ask him, how is your journey down? I'm sure he did, but the Torah didn't record that. The Torah records the conversation of, how old are you? Oh, 130, man, it's been tough. Okay, now let's move on with our story. Really? This is what the Torah has to tell us about? The conversation between Pharaoh and Jacob? Come on. Folks, if nothing else, I hope to train each and every one of you. Read the text. Read it and ask yourself, why are we being told these pieces of information? It's not some cool storybook. If it's recorded, there's something critical to learn. So what is this conversation about? So some of the commentaries point out that you know, when would you ask somebody how old they are? Typically, if one, you're not afraid of what the answer of someone being offended that you asked the question, but there's something out of the ordinary, right? If you see a middle-aged person walking down the street, you don't just go up and say, hey, how old are you? That's just normal. There's something out of the ordinary. You see, like an older person, Ardeen, just nothing personal, but the fact that, thank God, you're celebrating soon your 90th birthday, people will ask, oh, wow, how old are you? Why? Because living to 90, thank God, is a blessing. It's not every day that people get to live that long. And God should grant you many more years, Ardeen. Right? You know what I'm saying? So what triggered Pharaoh asking Jacob how old he was? So the commentaries point out that, I'll teach you a Yiddish word. Liz, make a note of it. Tzebrachen. Tzebrachen means broken. A tzebrachen a mensch means the person looked broken. He looked old, even beyond his years. He comes down to Pharaoh. You would think if you have an audience with the king, you dress nicely, you put on your best smile. I don't care how you really feel that day. Make it look good. Fake it till you make it, you know. But no. Jacob comes in and he looks like the Tzebrachan Amench. He looks. So Pharaoh says to him, how old are you? How old are you? Thanks, Rabbi. Right? To which Jacob's response was, I'm only 130, but it hasn't been easy. And who knows? I don't even know if I'll live as long as my father who lived to 180 or my grandfather who lived to 175. Ay, 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 ay. Do you know that in the Talmud, that in the Midrash, God is not happy with that response? Jacob is taken to task for that kind of response. Why? Because imagine You are living now in 2020. You're living in 57, what are we in? 5781. 5781. We know the end of the story. We know that in the end, it all turned out great. The whole reason why this played out the way it was is so that Joseph could be in the right position, so that ultimately the Jews would go through the Egyptian servitude that they had to, but ultimately we're going to be redeemed, given a Torah, brought to the land of Israel, a temple was built. Like, there's good stuff coming. We have the good fortune of being able to look backwards. Jacob, God says, as quoted in the Midrash, God says, Jacob, I'm setting in motion something that's going to be great for you and your family. And all you can do is kvetch? Oh, it's such a rough life. Yaakov, come on. It's going to be good. Trust me. Stick with me a little longer. Yaakov has to understand that there's a bigger picture. I'm going to switch over to the other message in a moment, but Yaakov finally gets the hint. He gets the hint right before he dies. When Joseph comes to him as Yaakov is getting soon to pass away, Jacob tells Joseph about that he has been blessed. Oops, sorry. Hold on.
I thought that was my house, so glad it was yours.
No, it's mine. It's mine. Sorry. Supper's on its way. Here's what it says. I lost my place. Oh, here it is. Yeah, this is the section. Here it is. Okay. He blesses Ephraim and Manasseh, right? Those are his grandsons. Here's what it says. He switches his hands. Fine. He blessed Joseph and he said, O God, before whom my forefathers Abraham and Isaac walk, God who shepherds me from my inception until this day, I now realize that God has been my shepherd. We're going to focus on that for 1 second. May the angel who redeems me from all evil bless the children, and may my name be declared upon them in the name of my forefathers, Abraham and Isaac, and may they proliferate abundantly like fish within the land. He gives a blessing. Here is the first time in history that God is given the title, so to say, of my shepherd. We all know it from King David, Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Yeah, well, he's late. He's the Johnny come lately. Jacob beat him to it. Jacob is the first one to call God the shepherd. Now in Hebrew, the word shepherd is called a ro'eh. Resh ayin hey, ro'eh. And that's how it's spelled. Typically, it would have resh vav ayin hey. In this particular context, it's spelled just resh ayin hey, ro'eh. But if you look at that word resh ayin hey, it spells the word ra'ah, which means evil. You know what occurred to Jacob finally, as he's just about ready to depart this world? That what I thought all these years was ra'ah, was evil, was really God just being ro'ah. God was shepherding me. I didn't realize it. The job of a shepherd is to turn the sheep one way or another. Why? The sheep want to stop. He pushes forward. They're tired. He keeps pushing. Why? Because he knows that right behind them is a den of foxes. He has to keep going. It's for the sheep's benefit, or vice versa. They want to go towards this area. They want to, go graze there. And he pushes them the other way. Why? They don't understand. They think he's cruel. But he knows that right over the next ridge is a beautiful oasis, is a beautiful place for them to drink, be comfortable. A shepherd has the best interest of the sheep in mind. Jacob finally comes to the realization that all of his life, yes, there were challenges. Life wasn't peachy, but it was all with the perspective of a long view. Look at the long picture, the big overall picture. He finally understands that and says, the God who I thought Ra'ah was evil was really Ro'ah, was really the shepherd all along. This is the meaning of this medrash that we started with. Do you want to know what was the merit or what was that started the whole process of ultimately concluding with the splitting of the sea as the Jews were able to leave the Exodus from Egypt? It was the very seeds that were planted in the very beginning of Joseph and his brothers being given this coat of many colors. The seeds of the Exodus were already planted hundreds and hundreds of years earlier. Hence, the allusion, the hint to this concept is in the word pasim, that multicolored coat. It spells pas yam, that splitting, that pathway through the sea. Yeah, hundreds and hundreds of years later. When did that first begin? Right here. In our story of Joseph and his brothers. This is the meaning that the Medrash wants to convey to us, that when it comes to history, when it comes to events, both on a personal level and certainly on a national level, you cannot have short-sightedness. It's long view only. That's how we have to look at it. The story of Joseph is already the seeds of the Exodus splitting. Now, I want to add one more piece to this because there's one other aspect that I think really needs to be brought out. The Midrash tells us something more in another place, that when the Jews got to the sea after that experience of the Exodus, 7 days after physically leaving Egypt, the Egyptians are now chasing them again. There's nowhere to go. They're facing the sea in front of them, the Egyptians behind. There's nowhere to go. The Medrash tells us that the sea, even though Moshe told it to split, it initially refused to do it. It refused to do it. Again, as we talk about very often with Midrashim, using a Midrash, I don't mean to suggest that everything is to be taken literally. There's a whole discussion about what function it is. But one thing is clear. The Medrash is conveying a message, a lesson for us to learn from. Whether it's literal or not, I leave that up for greater scholars than myself. But the Medrash says that the sea refused to split until the sea saw that the ark, the coffin of Joseph, who had made the Jews promise not to be left behind in Egypt. And when the day was to come that they were going to leave, they were to take his bones out. The Medrash says that when the sea saw Joseph's coffin, it said, oh, and then it split so that everyone can pass through. Again, the commentators want to understand what's the significance that it saw Joseph. Did it not see the other brothers like Reuven and Shimon and Levi and all the other Joseph's brothers? They also were taken out. Why specifically Joseph's bones? Why specifically Joseph's coffin was enough to say the sea, split? So based on our first part of the conversation, we understand because the sea understood that this was its time to complete the process that started way back when with Joseph. That's one possibility, but there's another one. This is the second lesson I want to share with you. Joseph has one characteristic that is different than his brothers that is a game changer. Joseph, when he's down in Egypt, when he's first brought down there, he was sold as a slave to a man named Potiphar. Potiphar, that was his name. He was the head executioner, actually. He was in charge of all the jails. He was the head of the entire criminal system down in Egypt. Okay? You know, I'm sure Joseph would love to put that on his resume when he was moving up the ranks. Hey, I interned by the chief executioner. Great. Okay. So he's there. But we know that the Torah tells us that Potiphar's wife, and I'll be as, you know, as... adult about it as I can, had the hots for Joseph and tried in many, many different ways to try to seduce him. Right? We're familiar with this part of the story. If not, watch the movie. Okay? Yeah. But be careful. Some are more X-rated than others. Okay? So you have, she's trying her best. She's trying her best. And of course, the situation actually presents itself where he's alone with her in the house. And she says, today's the day. I'm going to make my move. So she goes and she actually takes hold of Joseph. It's time for a decision, Joseph. Are you in or out? He's thinking to himself, am I going to commit the crime? Am I going to commit this terribly immoral sin? Or am I going to get out of here? He decides on the latter. And unfortunately, however, the story goes that she, holding his garment as he pulls away and to run outside, and I'm using those words specifically, run outside, fleeing the scene, she's left holding a piece of his garment. He's then, of course, she's embarrassed. So she turns the story around and says, he tried to do things to her. She fought him off. Look, here's the garment. And that's how he gets up. That's how he falls into prison, because Potiphar has no choice. Whether he believes his wife or not is irrelevant. He was going to defend her and throws him into prison. And we know the rest of the story. I'm using those words very carefully. The Torah uses the words, Vayanus Hachutza. He fled outside. He got out of there as fast as he could. There's one other place where that term is used, in a previous story of someone who also went outside. Anybody?
Avram?
Yes, very good. When Abraham was being given he was told that he brought up to God's attention that he had no children. He wanted a child. So what did God do? God told him, say hachutza, go outside and go look up at the stars and count them. Just as you can't count the stars in heaven, so too will your descendants be as numerous as the stars in heaven. Okay. I know, and everybody here knows, that you can't see the stars inside your home, inside the tent. Why is it necessary to use the phrase, go outside and see the stars? Duh. Again, Torah doesn't just use words for poetic license. It's there to teach me. So the Medrash makes the connection. Just as Avraham was being told, get out of your normal, natural situation, you have the ability to go above and beyond, almost against your nature. What does that mean? Right after that story, Avram's name is changed from Avram to Avraham. He becomes a new person. True, under natural circumstances, Abram was not destined to have a child. But God says, get out. You're not stuck. You can go and change your nature. Go look up at the stars. You can go beyond the stars. You have a connection to me, God says. Go outside of your natural limitations. Now let's bring it back to Joseph. The average guy in a situation like that would probably succumb to the pressure. It's his master. This is his livelihood. He's got to make his masters happy. Some guys would even take the opportunity and say, hey, this is great. But Yosef says, I can't. I'm going to go against my nature. Of course, my Yetzer Hara, my evil inclination is saying, go for it, go for it. He says, no, I have to fight against it. I got to go against my natural inclination. And I'm going to go outside. I'm going to go outside my natural limitations. You follow this connection? Now let's bring it home. The Jews are now going and they're standing at the sea. The Egyptians are chasing them. And the sea sees Moshe raise his staff and command it to split. And the sea thinks to itself, why should I split for you? God created me with my natural abilities to go and stick together. Water generally clings to each other. Take two drops of water near, in a matter of moments, They will find each other and merge. Water doesn't naturally split. They join together. Moshe, you want me to go against my natural tendencies? Why? This is how God created me. I don't have to go against my nature. You're asking me to go outside of that? Why? Until the sea saw Joseph's coffin. Joseph, oh, the sea looks and says, whoa, here comes somebody who taught us a lesson, who taught us that even though the natural inclination was to not leave, stay, commit the sin, that's a natural inclination, yet he went outside of it. He broke with his nature. I stand in awe of somebody like that. I too will go against my nature and split. The two lessons I'm trying to impart to you is that the story of Joseph being given this coat is a chain reaction of a much longer view of history that plays itself out with the Exodus, but also knowing that the key person, the key player in all of this, if I were to ask you, who's the key player in the story of the Exodus? 100% of you would say Moses. 100% of you. I know, God. I know. But in terms of, you would not have said Joseph. I don't think you would have. The Medrash is telling us he is. Because number one, he was the mechanism by which the whole story plays out. And number two, he was of the character that is deserving of splitting the sea. That's what this is talking about. The seeds of the Exodus are planted early on in the story. And Joseph himself is the one who epitomized the concept of that you have the ability to go against your nature. I had a teacher once who, I had a classmate who was acting up in class. And the teacher says to him, so-and-so, why are you doing this? What are you doing in class? He says, Rabbi, that's just who I am. He looked him square in the eye and he says, that's the crime, not the excuse. Just because that's who you are, that doesn't give you license to act on it. Change it. Who says you have to do that? That's the crime, not the excuse. Joseph understood this. This is what we need to understand. We all have certain inclinations. Thank God, many of them positive, but some of them are challenging for us. And each one of us has our own, whether it's in the realm of miserliness, whether it's in the realm of anger, whether it's in the realm of I don't know, pick any trait that we want to work on. We all face that challenge. Never stop yourself from trying to change that because you can. Never say, I can't change who I am. It's not true. It's not true. Yes, you were born with a certain tendency. You were born with a certain temperament, but it can change. Joseph is the prototype to teach us that. That is what I believe one of the most important lessons from the whole story with Joseph. Taking these two aspects, that Joseph is the representation of the long view, stop being so short-sighted, and learning that we can change our behavior. We can change our nature. We are not locked in. That's just the way I am. No. That's the crime, not the excuse. These are the two ideas. So the name of the class was, what does Joseph's coat, or I forgot the exact, right? What's his thing got to do with, what's he doing at the splitting of the sea? Yeah, it's got everything to do with the splitting of the sea. This is all out of the story of Joseph. Questions, comments, rebuttal.
So, since his tunic was tunic possum, does that mean it was playing dead?
What?
Possum plays dead. So his jacket, his coat was jacket, was just playing dead.
Okay. Yes. What? The answer to the question is yes, I think.
No, seriously, I do have a question. When you were talking about that the splitting of the sea didn't happen for almost 200 years after or more. Okay. But we've always what I've always learned from you is whatever, is that every event, including this COVID that's going on, is in the Torah somewhere. So it was.
Are you asking me where it is?
No. I'm asking
way
you.
Way above my pay scale, baby.
No.
Way up there.
No, the fact that the thing with Joseph was already. How am I putting this? Is that the splitting of the sea happened so far after Joseph. So is that relative to all the stuff that's in the Torah that's taking all the events that have taken place in the world that are already in the Torah?
Everything that has happened and will happen is alluded to somewhere in the Torah. There's no question about that. The only question that you and I face and everybody faces is, where is it? So going in the forward direction, like I'm not able to open up the Torah and say, here's what's going to happen in 2021. I have no clue whatsoever.
Right.
However, can great sages look backwards and say, this has happened in history. Here's where it might be alluded to in the Torah. Yeah, we can do that, but that's going backwards, not forward.
Right. No, I know we can't go forward.
At the end, when this is all over, and it might not be this year, I don't mean COVID. I mean, for at some point, we will see where COVID played is alluded to in the Torah. Not even a question in my mind. Where, what parasha, which set? I have no idea. Not even a clue. But is COVID here? Absolutely. Absolutely. And the impact that it has on world history. Yeah, it's all here. But I have no idea where. I'll have to ask Rabbi Dave for a raise for that. That's way, way up there. I got a lot more to learn. Anyone else?
Rabbi.
Yes, John.
I read a commentary in the Parsha talked about how the coat was a symbol, a mark of leadership, that Jacob saw that Joseph was going to be a great leader, and that's why he gave him the coat as a symbol of leadership. So, of course, I was thinking when you talked about the splitting of the sea, I was thinking more in terms of Moses exhibiting a mark or a symbol of leadership. So that's the way I interpreted your question.
That's fine. I think it's a very valid point. It's part of a larger discussion, but what was up with the two dreams that Joseph had? Are these just, dreams are dreams? You make out of it whatever you want. No. If the Torah is recording dreams, they're all prophecies. They're all foretelling something of the future. And yeah, it plays out exactly as the dreams had it. There was the occasion of where the 11 brothers were all bowing to him. That played out in reality. And even to the extent of the sun and the moon and all of that, referring to Jacob himself. Yeah, that plays out too. So yes, Jacob has an understanding that Joseph will play a role of leadership in his family and going forward. Where the difficulty is how does that translate vis-a-vis the other brothers? Like I guess part of the question is if you know this, right, as the parent, there's got to be some way to let the other children know how this is to, play itself out, and don't let it get to a point of jealousy and anger and hatred the way it does play out. It's hard to fully understand where was Jacob in all of this. If he had the inkling that Joseph was meant for leadership, then I don't know. Maybe something could have been done with his own, with the other children. I don't know. I grapple with this.
Rabbi, the phrase, I think you said it was possum, the path through the sea. I think of that Joseph's coat, and that phrase is talking about also his path through through Egypt in keeping his own faith and sticking to the things that he was taught by his father.
Excellent.
So that, you know, when he left, his children had Hebrew names. He just didn't do anything that was
outside. He stayed on the path. Beautiful idea.
Stayed on the path. Yeah.
Beautiful idea. I love it. Love it. All right. If nobody else, then I'll.
No, I have a question.
Yes, please.
Because I feel like Jacob, particularly after the last Torah portion, where I don't think he played as strong a role as he could have to stop sort of the massacre at Shechem, that he was self-aware enough to say Joseph has a sign of leadership. Favoritism for him because of Rachel, definitely, but leadership and the ability to sort of rein the other brothers in wasn't there. In fact, the only person that I saw that sort of could do that was Reuven, and he...
Well, Yehuda plays a very important role there as well. Judah definitely plays that role. In fact, the brothers all turn to him for advice, and unfortunately, at the first stage, he makes the wrong choice. But if you know the end of the story, it's Yehuda himself who stands up against Joseph and says, "Uh-uh, I'm not doing this mistake again. If you're holding on to Benjamin, I will fight you tooth and nail. I'm not letting this happen again." So, Judah really, at the end of the story, the two tribes that are the real source of leadership in the Jewish people are Judah and Joseph. Those are the two. Reuven loses that opportunity. He has some level, but it's not. It's Judah and Joseph. And there's a lot of discussion exactly how the two play off of each other. And they're not, the end of the story is the end. The end of the story. In the books of the prophets, they talk about the merging of Judah and Joseph. There is a merging of that. So what started out as tremendous disunity within the brothers ultimately ends with unity. How that all plays out, you know, stick around. It's a long view. All right.
That is playing the long view.
It's the only way. It's the only way. It really is. We are that guy in shul who's been here, you know, for a little bit of time, and we think we got all the answers. We're not. If we're lucky, we're here for 120, and even that's just a fraction of what's the real deal. Something to keep in mind. All right. Have a great night, everybody. A good Shabbos.
Thank you. Thank you.
Shabbos.
Thank you. Happy
Hanukkah.
Yes, very much so.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, guys.